This is Revolutionizing Recruitment with Kathleen Duffy, the arts of attracting, acquiring, and retaining talent. Here's Kathleen.
My guest this week is Shally Steckrell, who has been called the father of sourcing. Shally's the president of the Sourcing Institute and is a globally recognized recruiting leader who's been helping build sourcing organizations for major companies such as Microsoft, Google, and Coca-Cola. Shally, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you. It's such an honor to be here. So glad to be here. Appreciate the invite.
You know, I love your Twitter bio, and it says, provoking thought and providing instant pain relief for talent sourcing and recruiting agony since 1996. And I read your sourcing story that was posted in February of 2021. And I remember when you and I first met, and I was thinking that was about the late 90s, right?
98.
Yep. Moon Valley Country Club.
Right. In Scottsdale, I think.
Yep. And you were a visionary and really began connecting with people online immediately. You know, you are the evangelist and are now considered the father of sourcing, as I said. But I'm kind of wondering, I've also heard that you're the godfather of sourcing. So which of it is?
You know, both of those are made up by other people. I didn't choose either. I'd say probably the father of sourcing, because godfather sounds a little ominous, right? Like,
yeah,
I'll ask him for a favor he can't refuse, you know?
Right. We won't be seeing horses in someone's
bed,
right?
Mm-hmm. Not that kind of godfather.
Yeah.
I think it's just a way of saying, you know, I'm kind of an elder in the community, and that's unique because this is such a new job, right? The job of talent sourcing as an independent specialization outside of recruiting. So, you know, the specialization of recruiting into talent sourcing hasn't stood on its own for more than 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
So there's really, you know, I'm one of the very few elders in the industry. I'm an antique.
I feel your pain, my friend. Well, tell us why you've dedicated such a big part of your life to teaching your methods.
Well, they say that teaching and writing are diseases that you have. They're not contagious, but it's something that you just, when you have it in you, you have to do it. And there's definitely some truth to that, although I think I'm done writing after my third book. So three books and I'm done. But teaching has always been something that I enjoy doing because of two really important reasons. Number one, selfishly, I feel like I learn when I teach. So if I have an idea, a thought, something that I'm refining, a technique, the more I teach it, the more I discover about it and the more I learn about it. So teaching to learn, essentially. And the other one is there's an immense pleasure that comes from the light bulb going on when you're talking to somebody and they get it. And it's this sense of astonishment and relief, and you know that their lives will be better as a result of this moment that they've had of discovery. So there's a bit of the reward there that's inherent in that. And it's kind of addictive. So for those two reasons, I really just haven't been able to stop doing it.
Well, I know that there are many, many hundreds of thousands of people out there who really appreciate it and don't want you to stop. You know, you mentioned your disease of one of them being writing, and I'm sorry to hear that you're probably going to stop on your third book. But you'll laugh. I was looking at my bookshelf the other day, and I found your book, Electronic Recruiting 101, the 2005 edition. 15 years can really seem like ancient history in the world of the internet. From your perspective, what do you think's changed the most in our sourcing and recruiting space, really just in the last 5 years?
Well, Kathleen, you and I go way back a long time. You were in the business long before I even got started. And you've always been, in a way for me, my guru on research. But research back then was very different than it is today, in that it was a lot more about calling and asking questions, almost like an investigative journalist. I think there's some parallel or comparison to that, the way we used to do research, you know, before the internet, right? It was sometimes in libraries, sometimes with books and directories, but a lot of phone calling and asking questions. What has changed is that nowadays we don't need to figure out what questions to ask. The internet is a good source of information to prepare us for the questions. But those that are really good at it, they still do the same thing you and I did 25 years ago. They still make the calls. They still do the traditional research and investigative journalism kind of approach. But the internet informs our questions so we can be better prepared. And it allows us to get to the answers faster. Sort of like you can fill in big chunks of the org chart by doing your online research. And then when you actually start calling, you just have to fill in some blanks instead of kind of starting from scratch like we used to back in the day. So that's, I think that's the biggest change, is the availability of information has provided us a smoother transition into being able to ask the questions when we actually make the calls.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree. You know, and it's interesting because when I speak to people, I talk about sourcing as being more of an art than a science. We've always, you know, because of our model and the orientation on research, it's really that human spark of creativity and really applying the human intuition. And so we talk about, you know, sourcers as having these skills to locate candidates that companies may not be able to find, or really to be able to think about a bit more out of the box and turn up candidates in new and unusual ways. And you know, a lot of times I use the description as to these folks that are, you know, like this is rocket science to them, that this is really an excavation project. You know, I also would always say, well, we're looking for a needle in a haystack, but, you know, you pointed out in an article that no longer is our task to find a needle in a haystack, but rather to find the needle in a stack of needles. So looking at trying to marry technology and human intuition, in your opinion, what are the best sourcing solutions that marry those two, the beauty of both of them?
That's a good question. And yeah, you're right about the change in the needle and the stack of needles. That really illustrates the problem that comes with having so much information overload. It's information bloat, which means that you have to dig through a lot more information to get to what matters. And that's how I'm going to answer your question, is the technology that helps us the best is the technology that allows us to visualize the data in ways that we can't imagine ourselves, so that we can identify patterns and discover connections that aren't visible to the naked eye, so to speak, or to the observing human that is looking at comparing, for example, resumes. So technology that is able to read context and extract subtext, that is able to infer and make lateral leaps of logic. And that's rare. There's not a lot of it out there. There's plenty of technology that aggregates information from the web, but that doesn't really help us, because all you're doing there is essentially absorbing content that is already out there, which you can find with any search engine. So I can't say a search engine is the best, because that means you still have to sift through tons and tons of information. I mean, if you were to type into Google VP of engineering at Uber, you're going to get so many results. In fact, you might even get the VP of engineering at Google from the last 7 or 8 different positions, right? There are probably 7 or 8 different people that have held that title over the years. Mm-hmm. So it's not even accurate, even though it's seemingly accurate. So the technology is technology that is assistive, that allows us to either visualize or make the connections or summarize, synthesize vast amounts of information. So taking big data and drawing patterns or making connections.
So when using the example of, you know, search engines pop up 7 names that have at least one time held the VP of engineering role at Google, then do you advocate to these folks that are clamoring to learn from you, you got to pick up the phone and verify who that person is? Or are there other tools that enable them to do that?
It's always best to pick up the phone and reach out anyways, not mm-hmm. just to verify, but to make the connection. Even in technology, with roles like software engineers and directors of software engineering, they're much more likely to answer your call if they've received an email, for example. So it's a combination of emailing them and calling them, but they're also much more likely to respond to your email if you've called them. So it's imperative that you continue to use the human approach of a telephone call, whether that's actually a telephone or not. Nowadays, you can reach out to someone via Teams or Slack or Messenger, and it's not even a phone call anymore. But that outreach, that voice-to-voice, that human outreach is absolutely critical if you want to get their attention and make a connection, not just to confirm. But I'm going to tell you the other thing is, I believe very strongly that when we are looking for someone who's already done the job, we're already going in the wrong direction. The reason I say that is because if you wanted to find somebody that's going to contribute to your organization in a multiplier effect, like what they refer to sometimes as 10x engineers, software engineers that can contribute 10 times more to the development of an application than, you know, all the other engineers. And that same concept exists in lots of roles. There's always that rainmaker salesperson, or the marketing visionary, or the product manager that gets it and gets the audience and is responsible for your product becoming number one. There's always that person. If you find that person before they become that person, you have an advantage. But if you find them after, now you've got to pay them a lot more, and there's no guarantee they'll be able to have a second act. Now, chances are they might, but there really isn't a guarantee. So by finding people that were there when the VP of engineering at Uber was a director of engineering, and finding others that influence them, that help them along the way, and that learn from them along the way, you might have access to a talent pool that is the next VP of engineering at Uber that hasn't been hired yet. And that's a far better hire than the one that's already done the job. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense. And I think people really, you know, if there's one thing that they take away today, that should be it, because we know that there's a war for talent, and we've got to start thinking out of the box and looking at different skills and experiences to be able to fill these positions. And I think you're spot on there, Shally.
That's something where sourcing can be of great assistance, because it allows us to identify the micro commonalities that are not obvious. It allows us to find people in their natural habitat before they evolve into that 10x, whatever, that rainmaker, etc. It's a way to look at, I like to call it peer regression, kind of like economic regression analysis, the root cause analysis. How did that person get there? Well, they got there through the support of lots of other people. They learned and they taught and they experienced lots of things. And along the way, they probably came in contact with others that are just as good or maybe even better at something, but not as public or not as visible.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know that a lot of sourcers out there, including the folks that are in my team, go out there and build the org charts, and it allows the clients to see what their competitors look like and what they're paying. And I think that allows them to see, not just to your point, who that person is that's doing the job today, but who those number two people are that can probably move into that role, because it helps them to understand what the big picture is out there, as opposed to just that minute, I have to go after somebody who has this title today.
Right. And also it gives them something to aspire to. If you call the VP of engineering and tell them that you want to hire a VP of engineering, that's not as exciting, because it's kind of a lateral move. But if you call the VP of engineering and tell them you want to hire a CTO and they could be the next CTO, that's a lot more enticing.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. I want to talk a little bit about LinkedIn, and I want you to tell us the story about how you convinced LinkedIn to let recruiters use the tool that now is LinkedIn Recruiter, because I think that's a pretty cool story.
Yeah, long time ago. So 2004, LinkedIn launched in 2003, and it was pretty small. It was just a connection of groups of people that already knew each other. The social networking architecture, SNA, of it was essentially focused on one cluster around people that were related to the founders. I was able to chat with Patrick Ewers and Konstantin Guerke, who were the other two very often forgotten or even ignored founders of LinkedIn. And Konstantin and Patrick were really pushing the boundaries on what can be done with this. They were both in different roles, but they wanted to figure out what to do with this technology. They knew that there was something there, but it hadn't found a home yet. And I kept, especially with Patrick, I kept putting that bug in their ear that there's a market, there's a population that would be willing to pay for access to other people's networks, because we do that right now through calling someone and asking for a referral. Recruiters are the ultimate, consummate professional networkers. Back then, I would call you, Kathleen, and say, hey, do you know someone that you can recommend? And you would connect me to that person, and then I would call them and kind of daisy chain that way. Mm-hmm. And I kept telling them that there was this opportunity, but they didn't really see it because they didn't really understand the market, not having anything to do with recruiting. It took probably about 2 years of continuously demonstrating to them the power of the network. I kept adding people to it, and I ended up adding 60,000 contacts to LinkedIn at that time. There was no limit. Mm-hmm. And those 60,000 became another cluster. So when Patrick finally realized what was going on, Patrick Ewers, and he drew the SNA map, he identified that there were three distinct clouds or clusters of connections. The original one, which they thought was just going to continue expanding. But then there was a dashed line to this other cloud that had formed for some reason, I don't know exactly how, in Brazil. And it was a very large cloud, almost as big as the original one. And then there was this third one that he couldn't figure out. Well, that was me. I was the third one. I had invited so many recruiters who had invited so many of their candidates and other people, because recruiters at that time, when it was still very much free, they recognized the power of the referral. And what we were talking about back then was, rather than Shally having to call Kathleen to ask for a referral, I can look at Kathleen's network and contact that referral directly by saying, hey, we both know Kathleen. And it sort of gets around, not in a negative way, it is able to leverage your first degree's network instead of having to bother your first degree. Rather than me having to bug you with a call or an email, I can sort of leapfrog you and go to your network. And that's okay, because it's fair play and my network is also available to yours. That was the power of it. Recruiters realized that, so they started adding. And that cloud grew really, really big. So it wasn't until much later, I believe it was 2007, when there was another Patrick who joined the organization and was the first product manager responsible for finding revenue generating markets. And again, I started, bending his ear, talking about Patrick's and Konstantin's conversations. Both of them were gone at this point. So I was trying to find another home, another mm-hmm. ear to listen. And so he finally agreed to talk to me, and we had a very long conversation. His original vision was to expand into the venture capital world, to use LinkedIn as a platform for connecting with the next unicorn, connecting people that were going to be funding and founding and creating ideas and projects and companies. And the other side of it was also the sales world. So they wanted to grow LinkedIn as a sales referral. Well, he wanted to grow LinkedIn as a sales referral tool and as a venture capital kind of network. So I told him about recruiting and convinced him to give it a try. He hired me on as a consultant. And for a year, we went through all these different variations and ideations of what it would look like. Some of them kind of laughable, because LinkedIn was trying to find ways to scale without costing too much at a very young age. For example, one of the ideas that they asked about was, what if we limited first degree to second degree only? So you would only have first and second degree and no third degree. I said, if you do that, all the recruiters will leave, because that's the advantage. The recruiters are here because they want the second degree to connect to the third degree. They don't want to go to Kathleen to ask Kathleen for their first degree. They want to go to Kathleen's first degree to ask for their second degree, which is a third degree to them. And mm-hmm. he got it. And so when they finally realized kind of the power of this, they started building this app. And the first time that they launched it, they snubbed executive recruiting firms. You might remember mm-hmm. that.
I
it
do.
Was like, oh, we don't allow executives. Your staffing firm, we're not going to sell. This is corporate only, which was another idea of theirs that I vehemently opposed. But they thought that the money was where the employers are. They didn't realize that the employers are paying firms like yours to mm-hmm. do some of this work because they don't want to do it. And that's right. what you do. So anyway, long story short, it was basically 3 years in the making to convince them, and then another year of back and forth with thousands of, you know, iterations of what the product might look like. And then it was shelved for another year or two until somebody came in and actually, you know, picked it up and developed what we now know as LinkedIn Recruiter.
Well, it certainly has been an interesting evolution over there. And are you seeing that there are other sourcing tools beyond LinkedIn Recruiter that people need to be aware of or tapping into?
The short answer to that is yes, but it's not a single tool. It's a fragmenting of the marketplace. It's a specialization. Like in other industries, once you have an established marketplace, then you start seeing splinters of that marketplace that become subspecialties, kind of like Bitcoin. Bitcoin was the first one to say, hey, we're going to use this blockchain technology to come up with something new, and we're going to make it, you know, a currency that is free of all tethers to the real world, a digitally native currency. Everybody laughed at them, and it was a joke for a long time, and people were like, ha ha ha, Bitcoin. But then Bitcoin started gaining momentum, and now you have, I don't know how many dozens of other digital currencies that are, you know, different marketplaces. So what LinkedIn did isn't new. And the idea that I had to turn LinkedIn into a recruiting platform back in 2004, 2005, wasn't unique. It came from way back in 1997, 1998, there was a website called Six Degrees. And it was the very first of its kind where it was actually designed to allow people to connect to other people because of their six degrees. If you think of the old Kevin Bacon game that, you know, we might have played, 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, you know, somebody mm-hmm. who knows somebody who was in a movie with Kevin Bacon or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. That's what it was based on. But they didn't survive. After that, there was Orkut, which was a Google product. There were a few other iterations of it. Microsoft had an internal one that they created that was supposed to be behind the enterprise in using Active Directory and Exchange. But none of them really kind of took hold. So LinkedIn did, and it was the right mix of ease of use and product that took off. And so now we're seeing other networks like that, but they're not going to be an all-in-one network. We're seeing networks for developers, like the Dev.2 community. We're seeing networks for, there's even, believe it or not, there's a social media network for 18-wheeler drivers. It's a social media network or a social network for truck drivers that drive long haul because they have unique networking needs. Mm-hmm. So just like the invention of the dating app, which I think might have been Match.com, led to all the other variations of, you know, Farmer Date and J Date and all these other ones, that's what's going to happen. It's not going to be a bunch of different copycats of LinkedIn. It's different networks that appeal to different people and specializations. And they're not necessarily going to be designed for the same purpose. They're not all going to be for recruiting. Some of them are going to be for professional development. Some of them are going to be for open dialogue. Clubhouse, for example, is a new twist on the whole social media experiment. Clubhouse is an app where it's a phone call. It's audio only. There's no web pages. You have to connect to the app and basically tune in to a live call. That's a whole new, it's like, it reminds me of the party lines back in the day when you, you know, call someone and like people would answer, oh yeah, sorry, I'm trying to reach the Smiths. It's like that. So Clubhouse is a whole new take on with people who want to have a live conversation that's private and audio only because they want to be able to do other stuff while they listen, you know, with one ear and still do their work or email or whatever. So that's what's happening. You want to find people that are knowledgeable and influencers in non-frangible tokens, go to Clubhouse. So that's kind of what's happening.
Okay, good. Thank you. Well, hang on, Shally. We have to stop here. But coming up in the second part of my discussion with Shally Stickerell, the father of sourcing and the president at the Sourcing Institute, Shally talks about how folks can find the so-called invisible candidates.
So you're trying to find people that have the highest level of government clearance. Well, they're going to work at a handful of organizations. So you start with a list of companies and a list of locations and a list of division names. And you go from there. So you find what's around the invisible and then hone in on that.
This has been Revolutionizing Recruitment with Kathleen Duffy. To connect with Kathleen or to learn more about recruitment research, go to duffygroup.com.